From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Albert Einstein, images of an absent-minded genius, that crazy hair, that improbable E equal MC squared leap instantly to mind. 60 years after his death, the great physicist is the subject of a new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. In this hour, we explore the scientist, the humanist, the rebel, and the man, Albert Einstein. We begin with a developing news story. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger stepped down late today from his position as head of the independent commission assigned to investigate the attacks of 9/11. Gail Chadwick is covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us now. Hello, Gail.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Gail. Give us the latest. How did we learn of this resignation? Did Kissinger make any public statement, or is it all through the White House?
He has made a public statement. But the I think what is really so disturbing about this announcement to official Washington is it's an indication of the expectations being so enormously high for this commission. Expectations high for the families of the victims, high for the political class, which is going to see a report coming out on the most sensitive issue in American politics 6 months before a presidential election. I think it means that every step is going to be bound up with controversy, and that is what Mr. Kissinger is citing as the reason for his departure.
Gail, are you suggesting in that Henry Kissinger quailed at the prospect of having to deliver this report? What we're reading, what we're hearing is that it was more about the controversy over his undisclosed consultancy clients.
That is the controversy, of course. In fact, his comment was that he would have to dismantle his consulting firm to accept this job, which isn't quite what George Mitchell said on Wednesday, but actually very similar, that the commitments in terms of time, disclosure, and having to, there were even suggestions that he would have to resign from his law firm to meet all of the standards of accountability that the job would require.
A naming to a post doesn't get more high profile than the naming of Kissinger was to this post.
No.
How could it be, how could it have been that this problem wasn't anticipated by the White House or by Mr. Kissinger himself?
Well, I think the White House has argued that the White House appointments are not subject to the same disclosure rules that congressional appointments are, especially since Mr. Kissinger wouldn't be paid a salary. Now, that view is one that the Congressional Research Service contested in two reports, the most recent Senator Lieberman announced on Thursday, that, in fact, all 10 will have to meet the same accountability standards. It's a tough issue because, on the one hand, to make the commission credible, you need someone of immense stature and understanding. On the other hand, such people usually do have entangling connections. I think the obvious question would be, why not appoint Warren Rudman, who, along with Gary Hart, at least a year before the 9/11 attacks, was sounding the alarm across the board on this, conducted a very detailed study. And Trent Lott, when he gets through with his apologies, has until Sunday to make the last Republican appointments on that side. And I think there's a lot of interest in getting someone with the credibility of a Warren Rudman on this commission.
Well, the pressure will be great. As you say, it has become a doubly intimidating post, but surely not everyone with stature in the United States has entangling connections that go into the Middle East or into American law enforcement and intelligence agencies.
No, that's correct.
Gail, I just wonder if part of this didn't grow out of the Bush administration's rather successful track record in keeping information out of the public eye. Just last week, it was ultimately decided that Dick Cheney would not have to reveal who he talked to about energy policy. Maybe the Bush White House was simply thinking, we're establishing a new precedent for what's disclosed and what's not, and we can extend that to Henry Kissinger.
Well, they said that from the beginning. They felt that the tide had shifted too far in the other direction, and that certainly is a pattern with the resolution of the GAO suit. But I think Sunday, the announcement on Sunday is going to be very interesting, mm-hmm. whether they are able to pick someone who will have the credibility of, say, a Warren Rudman.
And remind us once more of when this report is supposed to come out. You noted that it will be engaged with the chemistry of a presidential election.
That's right. They have 18 months, so the report comes out about 6 months before a presidential election. And I think both parties are very concerned about that because, you know, the commission could focus on why the Clinton administration didn't do more with the al-Qaeda threat, mm-hmm. or focus more directly on what happened under the Bush watch. So there's a lot on both sides at stake here.
Gilchedek, last question. Was there shock in Washington today at this resignation, or had people come to expect it given the controversy that's whipped up over the week?
You know, has had a number of shocks recently. I think another one along the same lines was when William Webster, who has been regarded as, you know, one of the greatest of the gray heads, trust, you know, reputation untarnished, mm-hmm. trustworthy, he's the one you bring in to solve all sorts of difficult situations. When he was ruled out as kind of morally disqualified to deal with this oversight commission, oversight body that's dealing with corporate accountability, mm-hmm. The gray heads are falling in this city, and I think people are not quite shocked about it anymore, but they're realizing that one of the consequences of 9/11 and Enron has to dramatically increase the accountability of government and the importance of government, mm-hmm. and that the old standards of just being well-known or having a good reputation are not enough. You have to be transparent from a 360-degree angle.
Well, a very, very dramatic representation of that new dynamic today. Gilchedek, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gilchedek covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with us from Bethesda, Maryland. We're exploring Albert Einstein, the genius and the man tonight. A new Einstein exhibit recently opened at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. It explores Einstein's discoveries about time, space, and gravity. But it goes deeper to look at the activist who battled racism and anti-Semitism, the so-called father of the atom bomb, who was also a pacifist and an outspoken proponent of nuclear disarmament. Near the end of World War II, Einstein had this warning for the world, which rings chillingly true in 2002. He said, "There will be, in all countries, a pursuit of secret war preparations with technological means which will lead inevitably to preventative wars and to destruction even more terrible than the present destruction of life." Now, 82 years after Einstein won the Nobel Prize for Physics, the threat of nuclear weapons is glaringly real to the world again. Tonight, we're exploring the genius of Einstein and the man who carried it. Why are we endlessly captivated by Albert Einstein? Why is he the modern emblem of genius? And do we really want to know about his human frailties? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from New York is Michael Shara, an astrophysicist and curator of the exhibit Einstein, now on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Good evening and welcome, Michael Shara.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Michael Shara, help us dive into this. We're going to review the science a bit, but before we get there, those are formulas we've at least been taught once, and many of us don't know much more than that about Albert Einstein. What's the profile of the man beyond the science that emerges in this very in-depth exhibit?
He really was a human being. He cared deeply about other people. He cared deeply about the world that he lived in. And he taught us all that it was important not just to focus on our science and take our science very seriously, but also that we as scientists have an enormous social responsibility and must take that equally seriously.
And from that sense of social responsibility grew some both political beliefs and political problems in Albert Einstein's life.
He was willing to tackle really hard problems, social issues, things that most other scientists frankly shied away from. During the First World War, he was an avowed pacifist, signed a manifesto against Germany entering into the First World War or fighting in the First World War, one of only four intellectuals in the country willing to put their names, their reputations at stake in doing this. Mm-hmm. And it earned him a lot of enmity. After the Second World War, he was a strong advocate for nuclear disarmament, for world government, for pacifism, for socialism, at a time when all of these earned him nothing but disdain from the establishment, from the right-wing political establishment of the United States. Mm-hmm. And he really suffered, I think, because he had to defend people who were suffering and felt that he was one with them. He felt very strongly about this and was really willing to stick out his neck at a time when many people weren't.
Born in Germany, 1879, made most of his earth-shaking scientific pronouncements, discoveries, in the decade between or so between 1905 and 1916, moved to the U.S. in 1933 and died in 1955. Why do you think it's Albert Einstein, among all the brilliant scientists and innovators of the 20th century, who has become this emblem of the genius? Does that rest... does it rest first and foremost on the extraordinary substance of his science, or is there something about his persona that, that carries that iconography of genius so deeply into our minds?
It really is both of the above, but first and foremost, it is his science. In 1905, he wrote four papers which changed civilization. The world today, 100 years later, is utterly and completely different from what he did back then. We can trace, through the discovery of the Brownian motion, the understanding of molecules for the first time, the quantification of molecules, X-ray crystallography, the discovery of the structure of DNA, and the whole genomics revolution. That doesn't mean he was the father of genomics, but he laid the basis for understanding all of it. His discoveries of the photoelectric effect led to inexpensive vacuum tubes, integrated circuits, and the laptop on your desk, which really is traceable several discovery generations back to him. Mm-hmm. And finally, special relativity and the consequence E equals MC squared, mm-hmm. which leads to nuclear power plants, which leads to an understanding why stars shine, but also leads to an understanding or the underpinnings of the atomic bomb.
How deeply has Albert Einstein's manner of thinking been dissected during his life and after his life? I mean, when you put together this agglomeration of breakthroughs, it's so astonishing. We're left without words. What was the nature, the dynamic of the mind that produced these breakthroughs?
If I understood it better, I'd probably be making my own breakthroughs of similar magnitude. He was simply a brilliant man, but brilliant is a gross understatement mm-hmm. when it comes to him. He could see things that nobody else could see. He was willing to set aside not just the prejudices of a lifetime, the acquired prejudices of what space and time and energy and matter were all about, but the acquired prejudices of the entire human race over human history. He could simply set these aside and look at the universe with fresh eyes in a way that nobody had ever done before.
What was the temperament of that viewing, of that vision? I mean, the famous photograph shows him as this, you know, wild-haired, rumpled, kind of doleful expression, looking kind, looking gentle. We read that into it, but I have no idea if that's really the man who carried this you know, beams of genius.
He was once asked what the secret of his hairdo was, and he said, neglect. He focused on the universe rather than on personal wealth or personal appearance. I think he took his science and the social causes he believed in extraordinarily seriously, and he took himself not at all seriously. That was the true nature of the human being.
So playful or stern when he was focused on science? What was the attitude?
Well, when he was doing science, he turned off absolutely everything and everybody else. He could go for days without sleep. He could go for days without eating or drinking. He was simply focused on trying to understand why gravity worked. He was trying to understand what it would be like to ride on a beam of light. What would you see? He was trying to understand the fundamental nature of space and time. And in order to do that, go where no scientist had ever gone before, he needed needed to shut out the universe completely, and he had the capacity to do that, to essentially shut himself into a universe of his own. When it came time to do the social things, to interact with people, to use his fame to really have an impact in the world, he was willing to do that. He was willing to take on the burden of telling people what he thought was wrong about the world and wrong about society.
But that was another time. We're talking this hour about Albert Einstein, the man, the humanist, the rebel, and yes, the scientist. Why are we endlessly captivated by Albert Einstein? Why is he the modern emblem of genius, of all the geniuses of the last century? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and mind of Albert Einstein. Here's a clip of Einstein speaking about the danger of nuclear war.
Annihilation of any life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibilities. The ghost-like character of this development lies in its apparently compulsory trend. Every step appears as the unavoidable consequence of the preceding one. In the end, there beacons more and more clearly general annihilation.
And there it is. Hard to understand, but you can hear that German voice, and you can hear those, maybe you can make out some of what he's saying there about how technology has had, in his day and in ours, brought into technological possibility the elimination of human life on Earth. This was not a man who was unaware of the potential consequences of the breakthroughs that he was making and others were making in his wake. We're joined tonight by Michael Scherer. He's curator of the new exhibit Einstein on display now at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's chairman of the museum's astrophysics department. You can join us as well. What do you read into that shaggy hair, those sleepy, twinkling eyes? Can you imagine bearing all that genius but not controlling the end to which it would be used? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Scherer, can you draw a line for us between Einstein's discoveries and the weapons of mass destruction, to use a very current term that he was just talking about in this heavily accented and a bit scratchy tape recording? It's really these discoveries from 1905 that came to fruition four decades later during World War I, was it not?
That's right. He came up with E equals MC squared in 1905, and he regarded as a bit of almost a hoot. The quotes, or one of the quotes in the time is, "I think God might be laughing at me, that he has played a subtle trick on me."
And help us understand the humor.
Well, E equals MC squared seems so beautiful to him that mass and energy are really the same thing, just as U.S. dollars and British pounds are the same thing.
Interchangeable.
The conversion factor there is 1.5. Mm-hmm. Between energy and mass, it happens to be 1 with 21 zeros after it, but it's the same thing. Energy and mass are the same. And a tiny little bit of mass, say the amount of matter in a penny, is enough to power Boston for about 5 or 6 years, produce all the energy
that Boston
needs.
If you could run it through a nuclear generator.
Exactly.
Of some kind.
If you could release that energy somehow. And unfortunately, or fortunately, with uranium and plutonium, you can do it in a controlled fashion in a nuclear power plant. You can also do it in an uncontrolled fashion in an atomic bomb.
So the joke, Einstein, God's laughter, was that, ha-ha, these things which look so different to you are actually just the same thing packaged and compacted in different ways.
Exactly right. He realized that. He was the first one to realize that. It's certainly in 1905, I think he had no inkling that one could ever release the energy locked up in mass. It was only the experiments in Germany in 1938 and then in 1939 and the diffusion of that knowledge to America via Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and others who came and told him that fission was a real possibility and that chain reactions were a real possibility, that suddenly opened his eyes and made him realize, oh my gosh, E equals MC squared is a blueprint for weapons of mass destruction.
And at that point, he was not an absent-minded professor pondering this in his own little world. He reached into the very real world to touch FDR.
Exactly. He wrote a letter on August the 2nd, 1939, exactly 29 days before the Nazis invaded Poland. And he warned FDR of the consequences, told him that it might be possible to build bombs that could be smuggled into a port and destroy a port and the entire surrounding area, that the element uranium was critical to all of this, that the Nazis had taken over the best uranium mines in Czechoslovakia, and that the U.S., first of all, needed to ensure for itself a supply of uranium, and second of all, to begin large-scale experimentation beyond the meager things that could be accomplished in university laboratories, and do this as quickly as possible.
His science is so fascinating, we're tempted to get completely wrapped in it, but we want to understand something about his personal life as well, the character and the quality of his family relationships, his personal relationships.
Well, he was married twice. The first marriage came apart after a number of years. He was very passionate and wrote some extremely passionate love letters to Mileva Maric, his first wife. My favorite of the lot starts with a gorgeous quote. He starts it with, "My dear kitten." That's a great way to start a love letter. And then he says, "I've just read a wonderful paper by Lenard on the generation of cathode rays by ultraviolet radiation." Now, it is true
and
that
I'm all
she
inflamed
was a
with
physicist.
Passion. Okay.
That's right. Now, you know, she was a physicist,
yes.
So this may have turned her on even more than the "my dear kitten" part.
Right.
It's also true that the reason the marriage came apart was that he was seeing his second cousin, Elsa Lowenthal, who became his second wife. And he did have a string of mistresses in later life. So he was not the Saint Einstein that in some sense we've come to see him as, at least not in his personal life.
His observation was, marriage is the unsuccessful attempt to make something lasting out of an incident. I don't know about that physics as a pickup line, but I guess it worked with the first wife. What about in his friendships? Did his friendships were they mainly within the scientific community, or did they extend more broadly?
No, he had a tremendous number of very important people in the early part of this, or the first half of the century, whom we would consider to be, certainly were his close friends and correspondents, but also very simple everyday people. When he lived in Princeton, children felt comfortable with him, his neighbors felt comfortable with him and liked him a lot. But he corresponded with the likes of Sigmund Freud, for example. He didn't hesitate to pick up a pen to FDR when he felt it was necessary. And all of the great physicists of the world corresponded on a regular basis with him. In addition, when McCarthyism reared its head in the early 1950s, he wrote and corresponded regularly with people that he felt whom he felt were being oppressed and threatened, as well as some of the more powerful political people in the country. He was ready to talk to anybody, anytime.
I want to look more closely at Einstein's politics and how they interacted with the American government. Michael Scherer, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Fred Jerome, joining us also from New York. He's author of The Einstein File. He's a science writer and journalist. Next semester, he'll be teaching a course at the New School in New York called Scientist Rebels. Good evening and welcome, Fred Jerome.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Fred, talk to us about Albert Einstein's politics and how they intersected with the American political mainstream or left.
Well, that that clip you played a minute ago of Einstein criticizing the bomb-making capacity of the U.S.
Yes.
was actually broadcast on February 12th, 1950, on Eleanor Roosevelt's first public nationwide television program. And he and two weeks earlier, President Truman had announced the United States was going to launch a campaign, a program to build a hydrogen bomb, a bigger, better bomb than had ever been built in the history of the world. And this was going to save the nation. And Einstein went on the air 2 weeks later on this national television debut and said no. And he said that that program would lead to more arms race, more bombs, bigger bombs, better bombs on both sides. And to, as you heard him say, to world annihilation.
Yes.
The next morning, Monday morning, the 13th of February, J. Edgar Hoover walked into his office and issued a memo to every FBI office in the country ordering them to send to Washington any and all derogatory information they had on Albert Einstein, because he was going to centralize the Einstein file and a number of things followed from that.
And this was not the beginning of that kind of interest in Albert Einstein. In your book, The Einstein File, which opens up all those records and gets into every nook and cranny of what J. Edgar Hoover was up to there, you note that though his science was behind the creation of the atom bomb, he was explicitly, specifically barred from working on the Manhattan Project. How did that come to be?
Well, that's absolutely right, and it's little known, but in 1940, when the government was just 1 year after he had written the letter with Szilard to Roosevelt, urging him to undertake the Manhattan Project, the Army intelligence screened a whole bunch of potential scientists, and he was on the list to be screened, and they got their security information from none other than J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, who sent them a lot of the derogatory information that he had already collected on Einstein.
So what were the red flags that went up from J. Edgar Hoover or otherwise?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a complicated question. I think that there were scientists approved for that project who were more radical than Einstein, who were far to the left of Einstein.
We haven't really talked about his politics. Where did he stand in the spectrum?
Well, he was a socialist, as Michael said. He was a Democrat with a small D. He believed in human rights and dignity and the liberty, equality, fraternity, and so on, and took them very seriously. He was, above all, very much anti-fascist. He had been his political consciousness had been forged, although it began earlier. It was really forged in the flames of the rise of Nazism in Germany, and it affected his attitude towards discrimination against minorities of all kinds.
He was a socialist. Was he a Communist Party member?
No, he was not. Mm-hmm. And he had disagreements with the communists and certainly with Stalin and the Russians. But he felt the main threat came from the right. And from in this country, that meant McCarthy and Hoover. And he went out of his way to defend those, including communists, who were attacked by the McCarthyites. And at one point in 1953, publicly urged witnesses to refuse to answer questions from the McCarthy Committee and the House Un-American Activities Committee and other such committees. And he did this twice in 1953, both times, once in June and once in December, he was on the front page of the New York Times with these statements. And therefore, then as now, that meant he was on the front page of media around the world.
All of which suggests exactly the kind of framework that would lead the U.S. government perhaps not to want him on the Manhattan Project at that time. But you say J. Edgar Hoover had a 23-year campaign to undermine Einstein's influence, including illegally opening his mail, monitoring his phone, trying to link him to Soviet spies, trying to take away his American citizenship.
That's correct. A lot of this was contained in the papers. The first FBI file was released in 1983 to a professor in Florida after he spent 3 years of Freedom of Information Act requests to get them. And that file was only a partial file. About 70% of it was there. The rest of it was either blacked out or withheld. And I was able to get the rest of it in the spring of 2000. And so much of this information comes from the newly released pages as well as the older pages. One of the reasons, and this, it's a question, why Hoover was so obsessed with getting Einstein. And one of the reasons clearly was because he was Einstein.
Because he was such a big figure.
When Einstein spoke, as the commercial says, people listened.
It was an alternate pole of influence, and that was unacceptable.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And combine that with Einstein's attitudes, and combine that with the fact that Einstein also believed not just in making statements, as Michael has said, but in doing things.
He was
an activist. He joined 70 organizations, which are listed in the FBI file as subversive. He joined many more than 70 organizations, but 70 of them the FBI considered to be subversive. And many of these were, for example, anti-lynching organizations, anti-racist organizations, all of which cut against Hoover's right-wing grain.
Fred Jerome, Michael Shera, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. I want to turn to them. Rob's calling. Welcome, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I was curious I've never gotten a lot of depth on this, but Einstein's reluctance to embrace quantum mechanics, changing the tone from politics at this point, but in the famous quote, I guess, of God does not play dice.
Right.
And what was his, what was going on in his head with that, and Schrodinger and everything else having done work, you know, 20 years previous to his death and so forth, what was going on there to have him so, fighting against quantum mechanics?
Rob, thanks for the question. Michael Shera, do you agree? Was Einstein so reluctant to dive into quantum mechanics all the way through, and why?
In fact, he was one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, which is one of the fabulous contradictions of his life. The whole idea of the photoelectric effect lays some of the basis for quantum mechanics by showing that light has photon or quantum properties. It's not just a wave, it's also a particle. In retort to Einstein's statement that God does not play dice with the universe, the retort from Niels Bohr was, "Don't tell God what to do." And the two of them really liked each other. They admired each other, but they were in this struggle all of their lives. Einstein did reject the fundamental philosophical underpinnings of quantum mechanics.
Because of an element of randomness?
Exactly. He felt that it should be possible to build a physical theory of the universe that will allow you to predict with absolute certainty what would happen to an electron or to a galaxy or to the universe itself. And quantum mechanics tells you that you can't do that. There's an inherent uncertainty in the calculation of everything in the universe. That just rubbed him the wrong way.
Michael Shera, update us on that, because we know he was always driven by this vision of a grand unified theory, a physical a goal to describe all physical phenomena, I guess, under one theory that would link everything. So here we are, decades on. Who's in the lead? Is it the dice-playing quantum mechanics, or are we headed toward a grand unified theory?
The answer is that it's still, in a sense, neck and neck in the horse race, to use your analogy. The physicists of the 30s, 40s, and 50s who watched Einstein's toil at this felt that in some ways he was on a fool's errand, that what he was trying to do, build this simple grand unified theory that might overthrow quantum mechanics, simply couldn't be right under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. We see today that neither general relativity, his magnificent theory of gravity, nor quantum mechanics can stand by itself. Neither explains all phenomena in the universe. And to unify all the laws of physics, you need something better. Now, whether it is string theory or one of the other avant-garde theories of physics that are being proposed today, well, we don't know that. And only when we have such a theory will we be able to say that the universe is or is not fundamentally probabilistic at some level. It probably is. That's my feeling today.
And if we could sit down in the kind of highest tier of scientific physics conversation in the U.S. or in the world today, how would we find Albert Einstein regarded? Is he, at this point, almost a century after his great burst of discoveries, principles, is he considered musty, old, a little off, or is he still considered, you know, gleaming bright, right on?
Oh, absolutely. That's an understatement. In 1999, when two independent groups of astrophysicists discovered the acceleration of the universe, that the universe is not just expanding but accelerating, Albert Einstein's cosmological constant just leaps off the pages from general relativity theory. It tells us that there is a kind of negative gravity pervading the universe. And while Einstein himself at first discounted it, then took it more seriously, then discounted it again, oscillated during his life, it's pretty clear that the brilliance of general relativity theory and the cosmological constant are with us permanently, and that he was, if anything, still a century ahead of his time.
Einstein lives. Michael Shera, Fred Jerome, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about Albert Einstein, the man, the humanist, the rebel, the scientist. Can you feel a link between Einstein's science and his politics? And is this the man you want Einstein to be? Behind the myth, you can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Albert Einstein, the man, the humanist, the rebel, and, oh yeah, the scientist. Can you feel a link? Are you hearing it between Einstein's science and his politics? And should Einstein be held responsible for the atom bomb? Should scientists be responsible for what's made of their work? Can you imagine bearing all that genius, but not controlling the end to which it's used. And I guess finally, do we encourage this kind of genius today or stifle it, or does it matter? Does this kind of genius just explode on its own? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Fred Jerome. He's author of The Einstein File. And Michael Scherer, curator of the new exhibit Einstein, on display now at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Let's turn to a call. Mildred's calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Mildred. You're on the air.
Yes, I am. My stepfather attended Einstein's lectures in Berlin right after World War I. And he was also quite cognizant of the people who had taught Einstein and his wife, his first wife. And they gave credit to, I'm not a feminist, but they gave credit to her for the whole relativity formula.
More credit than history gives her in the shadow of her more famous husband.
Right. That he more or less snitched it from her. I'm not denigrating his genius, because there's no question of that. But the fact is that he wasn't quite honest. Most of the relativity thoughts and conclusions came from her.
Well let's hear about that, Mildred. It's a great observation, and I wanted to get to it. I thank you for your call. Michael Scherer, what about it? This is a theme that's come up in recent years. We hear more of it, that his first wife, I don't know if I have the pronunciation correct, but Mileva Maric?
That's correct.
A fellow physicist, as you pointed out, and perhaps a co-pilot on his journey to that theory. What do we know?
It's an interesting theory, and it has been discussed widely. Mileva certainly studied to be a physicist with Albert. It's also true that she failed her final exams twice. They married, and it is certainly true that he, at the very least, used her as a sounding board, tried out all of his theories, all of his ideas on her, and while there were forums going on in their house, she was present to hear the early ideas vis-a-vis relativity. Was she in some ways the co-author? I think not. I've certainly never seen any convincing argument that she was. Might she have been a bit of a muse? Might she have inspired him in some ways, perhaps sharpened his ideas? It is possible. It is true that in his 1905 paper on special relativity, he gives thanks to Michel Besso. He does acknowledge someone, his closest friend, whom he's bounced ideas off for a significant length of time. He does not acknowledge Mileva. Now, would she have remained married to him, or would she have remained silent, had she deserved a significant amount of credit there? Not at all clear. Mileva was very outspoken and did not hide her feelings about what was going on around her. What is certainly true is that by the time general relativity came along, they were no longer an item. They had been separated both spiritually and physically for a long time. And frankly, special relativity is the accomplishment is an accomplishment that any physicist would be enormously proud of. General relativity stands so far above it that there's nothing to compare, and there's really nobody who's come forward to claim any piece of it. It is true that there were mathematicians who helped him with the mathematics, but they were basically tool makers, and he used the tools to build this beautiful edifice, and that was all his.
So difficult to pull apart that internal dynamic of the marriage, but I hear you leaning very strongly toward the husband in this instance.
That's correct. She may have played a minor role, but I don't think that she was central to it.
What about Albert Einstein more generally? Was he the kind of scientist who was prepared to share credit? Was he as a young man, as a young scientist, ambitiously driven to, you know, single-handedly make these breakthroughs that would make his name? Was he that kind of man?
We don't see indications of him being cutthroat, and we see something on the contrary. A young Indian physicist by the name of Bose sent him a really clever paper later on in life about the statistics of things like photons or spinless particles. And Einstein could easily have stolen that idea for himself, misappropriated the idea. He gave Bose full credit and published it, sharpened the ideas up, sharpened the mathematics up, and it was published under both their names. These are referred refer to today as the Bose-Einstein statistics. So when he had the opportunity, he had the power and the position and the name, he didn't take advantage of it. He didn't try and steal others' ideas. And that's why I think that he was intellectually honest in giving credit where it was due.
Shahryar's calling. Welcome, Shahryar. You're on the air.
Hi. It's a great program.
Thank you.
I'm afraid that sometimes magnifying Einstein's genius to levels of godlike characters and superhuman status is detrimental for younger generation of physicists today who are striving to achieve the same types of rebellious, adventurous, and open-minded exploration of physics.
Well, why so? Why should it not be an inspiration? Is it just too daunting when we hail him so?
Right. Well, I mean, for example, if you show that Einstein was well above everybody else in the realm of thought and abstract analysis, that makes people think that, well, maybe I can't possibly reach that standard. But when you actually emphasize the most important characteristic that he had, and that was probably his rebelliousness, his essential need for open-minded review of everything and basically doubting everything, and, I mean, what is more fundamental than a space and time, and he even doubted that. And I think that is the more important aspect, that he wanted to understand things in a much more new perspective than previously.
It's a great observation. I want to turn it to Michael Scherer just for a moment. Michael Scherer, how do we give Albert Einstein his due without intimidating generations of scientists today thinking, oh, my gosh, how can I ever measure up?
Well, I think that most scientists have slightly more realistic expectations of themselves. Very few of us go into the game expecting that we're going to be another Einstein or that we're going to be able to overthrow all of the established scientific order. It would be wonderful if it happens for us and for science. We'd make great advances. But most of us who consider ourselves reasonably successful scientists take a particular problem or area of science, a subspecialty, and we chip away at it. And if we're lucky and reasonably good at our field, we can chip away a pretty good hunk and make some advance.
But I guess that raises this question, how do we keep the field open for the supernova like Einstein so that it's welcomed, it's encouraged, or does it matter? Is this kind of supernova going to blaze no matter what the context?
I think in most cases it will. Someone with a really good idea, with a fabulous idea, and in particular a testable fabulous idea, something that makes a prediction that hasn't been seen before, will inspire physicists, astrophysicists, chemists, mathematicians to go ahead and test it and demonstrate whether it's true or false. And if it's true, then the scientific acclaim is going to follow.
And I can jump in.
Fred Jerome, please.
Yeah. One thing Einstein said was, you know, I'm not more brilliant than everybody else. I'm just more curious. And that was undoubtedly modest. But the true part about his curiosity and his persistent curiosity, I think, is something that everyone can learn from and follow. And there's a great strength in that. And that goes with his challenging and mold-breaking approach to life as well.
Fred Jerome, speak to us for just a moment. Our time's running down. But Albert Einstein's relationship with Israel, what was it? And how important was it to him and to Israel?
Well, it was mixed, and I think he was, you know, Israel offered him in 1953, I believe, the presidency. When the first president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, died, the Prime Minister of Ben-Gurion offered Einstein the presidency, and he turned it down, partly because he was a scientist and not a politician, partly because he was too old, but partly also because he had some disagreements. And he considered, on the one hand, that being a Jew and his relationship with the Jewish religion was the most important part of his life. On the other hand, he disagreed with some of the attitudes that some of the Zionist leaders had towards the Arabs, and he argued strongly for many, many years for a more friendly, cooperative, sharing relationship. At one point, early before the forming of the State of Israel, argued for a combined state, a state that would represent Jews and Arabs. Later, after Israel was formed, he supported it. But he still continued to push the idea of a closer, friendlier relations relationship towards the Arabs.
And where he did focus most of his efforts, actually, was on the Hebrew University at Jerusalem. He considered this to be the single most important thing that he could do within the newfound state. And so he lobbied continuously for it, went to an enormous number of dinners, fundraised really all over the world to establish the Hebrew University. And even in death, he continues to support them because he's left all rights to his name and all of his scientific papers to them. And they are the ones really who've supplied us with this treasure trove at the museum, these fabulous documents from him.
Well, lucky for us, we could do another hour. We don't have it. Michael Scherer, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Michael Scherer is curator of the new exhibit, Einstein, on display now at the American Museum of Natural History. And Fred Jerome, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Fred Jerome is author of The Einstein File. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, what it's like to live in Einstein's house. This is On Point. When Albert Einstein moved to the United States in 1933, he settled into a modest house at 112 Mercer Street in Princeton, New Jersey, where he lived the rest of his life. When Gail Sawtelle's husband, Eric Maskin, accepted a position at Princeton University, they and their two kids moved to 112 Mercer Street. They quickly realized the Einstein House is a popular tourist attraction, bringing hundreds of uninvited visitors each week. In this diary, Gail says you don't have to be an Einstein to figure out that it hasn't been easy living in the genius's old haunt.
We do, in fact, have very many, many visitors, and I think that's the most difficult part of living here is keeping them from getting a little too close for comfort. They climb on the porch and peep in the windows, and some have even chipped away bits of the foundation as mementos. So it makes me feel a bit like I'm living at Graceland sometimes. Many people simply have their pictures taken in front of the house, which is fine. I'm quite happy to see visitors of that kind, but yes, many do knock, and I'm afraid that they don't realize that they're one of hundreds and thousands, and that it's impossible to show them around as it's a private house. They come morning, noon, and night. Because the house is unmarked, the neighbors often get asked for the exact location of the house, and when we lived across the street waiting for this house to be renovated, we'd have people 11 o'clock at night bashing on the door saying, "Where is Einstein's house?" And it's a bit odd. Well, it was a very modest little white clapboard house, some with black shutters and some Greek Revival details. The oldest part of it was probably built around 1840. It's really a very modest house. It stands very close to the street and very close to its neighbors. Not terribly imposing, and I guess it seems appropriate. He seemed a very modest, unimposing man. He's on record as caring about really one feature of the house, and that was the view from his study window over the garden. He loved the light. And I think he was a bit suspicious of bourgeois trappings in general, and wouldn't have minded living in a very simple way. The town sponsors tour groups, official ones. And in fact, I thought that these would be the respectful groups who would stand out in front of the house on the sidewalk. But the other day, there was the entire crowd piled onto the front porch for a group portrait. And, of course, the last stragglers peeped in at me sitting in the parlor. And that's a bit over the top for me. But I guess it's something that one has to get used to. Some days I'm more gracious than others. The town has created this ambiguity about the status of the house. On the one hand, it's on the tourist map. In fact, a number one on the tourist map, but it doesn't say the precise address, and of course, the house is not marked. So it gives a rather mixed message to people about the house's status. Many people do truly believe it's a public museum. And I think we comfort ourselves the fact that at least our many visitors are worshiping a great physicist and humanitarian and not just another rock star.
Gail Sawtelle lives in Albert Einstein's old house in Princeton, New Jersey, with her husband and two children. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR. We're